Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar titled Service Options for Relative Caregivers in Child-Only Cases. I'm James Butler from the Office of Family Assistance, and I serve as one of the program specialists here in the Self-Sufficiency Branch here in the Office of Family Assistance. Today's webinar brings forth an opportunity for us to share with you some of the latest research and ideas around relative caregivers and the child-only TANF caseload. Despite the fact that almost half of the national TANF caseload is comprised of child-only cases, little seems to be known about the needs, strengths, and barriers these families face. Many relative caregivers only receive cash grants to help them support and raise relative children. Several states, however, have started to offer more, and many have also created partnerships between TANF and child welfare programs to enhance support to relative caregivers and children. Our conversation today will focus on understanding these practices and policies. What services can TANF programs offer beyond cash assistance? How can TANF agencies work more effectively with child welfare agencies to coordinate services and approaches? Other objectives of today's conversation include understanding the importance and prevalence of, as well as the strengths, barriers, and outcomes related to relative caregivers and children in TANF child-only cases. Hearing experiences and lessons learned from a kinship navigator program that is providing support services to relatives and children in child-only cases. Learning about collaboration between TANF and child welfare systems to share data and provide services to relative caregivers and children. Today, we have four dynamic presenters who will guide us through this conversation. Throughout the presentation, you will have an opportunity to ask questions by using the chat box located in the bottom left corner of your screen. We encourage you to ask questions. If your question is for a specific presenter or program, please be sure to specify that. In the event we are not able to get to everyone's question, we will provide a Q&A on our PureTA website, along with a transcript and audio recording of today's webinar. During the webinar, there will also be a series of polling questions that will appear on your screen. Please answer each by clicking on the radio button next to your point of response. Doing so not only helps us guide the discussion, but also shares additional information that may inform your practice. So speaking to you first will be Matthew Stagner. He is a senior fellow and director of Chicago Community Services Research at Mathematica Policy Research, and a senior lecturer at the Irving B. Harris School of Public Policy Studies at the University of Chicago. He is co-author of the comprehensive report, TANF Child-Only Cases, Who Are They? What Policy Affects Them? What Is Being Done? And he previously served as the executive director of Chapin Hall, University of Chicago. After Matt, we'll hear from Liliana Hernandez, one of our program specialists in the Children's Bureau here at the Administration for Children and Families here in Washington, D.C. Her work focuses on the Title IV e-Guardianship Assistance Program, Child Welfare Waiver Demonstration, and the Family Connection Kinship Navigator Grant. Following Liliana, we'll hear from Julie Trinan, who served as program director at the Arizona Kinship Support Services, a program of Arizona's Children's Association. Julie also served as the project director of the Family Connection Grant, Child Welfare, TANF Collaboration, and Kinship and Education Program, funded by the Children's Bureau from 2012 through 2015. Last but not least, we will hear from Natalie Williams, who serves as the Strategic Planning Organizational Development Manager and Program Director for the Child Welfare Tenant Collaboration Grant in Jefferson County, Human Services, Colorado. So, just before Matt speaks, we went through out one of our first polling questions. So if you're all ready, our first polling question should be coming up shortly. The first polling question for all of the participants. What percentage of your TANF caseload consists of TANF relative caregiver child only cases? And your responses are A, less than 20%, B, between 20 and 50%, C, greater than 50%, or D, unsure. And we'll give you a few minutes to respond to that before we move forward. Okay, thank you everyone for your responses. So now without further ado, we will now hear from our first presenter, Matt Stagger. Matt, you have the
Thank you so much, James, for the introduction. And my role here will be to provide an overview from a report I participated in 2 to 3 years ago, and hopefully set the stage for then hearing from more of the practice and partitioner practice. And policymakers later in the presentation. So the report that I'm referring to is entitled, as James said, Children in TANF Child-Only Cases, Who Are They, What Policies Affect Them, and What Is Being Done. I worked on this project while at Chapin Hall, and it is a product of Chapin Hall. At the end of the presentation, I'll suggest a link so that if the details that I provide you'd like to dig into a little bit further, you may do that. The heavy lifting on the project was not done by me, even though I'm speaking today. It was done by Jane Malden, Richard Spiegelman, Christina Sogar, and Kinsey Dinan, and I want to thank them again for their work on this project. The motivation for the study was, as James said, we have a large but not well-understood population looking at child-only cases in TANF. Back before welfare reform in 1996, child-only cases were less than 15%. But because their numbers stabilized while adult-aided cases fell steadily, we now see, or we saw in 2010, that 2 in every 5 TANF cases were child-only. So there's a national situation of TANF-only child-only TANF cases being very large proportion of the caseload. But importantly, it's also the state policies differ dramatically in the use of foster care and TANF to support kin families. And we felt that policymakers need to better understand the nature, purpose, and effects of TANF child-only aid. This first chart, which is from the report, shows what I was just saying, that you'll see that one-parent families dropped dramatically after 1996 and then leveled off after about 2004, 2005. Meanwhile, child-only cases have remained somewhat steady and become a greater proportion of the caseload. First, about this project, it was funded by the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the Office of Planning, Research, and Evaluation in ACF. The project, as I said, was based at Chapin Hall with support from several subcontractors and assistants, the Child and Family Policy Institute of California, the Goldman School at Berkeley, the New York State Center for Employment Economic Supports, and the New York City Human Services Resources Administration. The data for the study came from several points. We wanted to look at a cross-state and over-time analysis of TANF cases by type. So we looked at state reports of TANF policies and caseload counts. We looked at administrative data over several years from four focal states, California, Florida, Illinois, and New York, and we broke out the cases by type of child-only case for 35 states in 2010. We also used population-based surveys and conducted interviews with agency staff, policymakers, and advocates in the four focal states. The first step, of course, is to define what we're talking about. And when we talk about child-only cases or families in child-only cases, it encompasses a set of case types which are really very different and need to be considered differently for policy purposes. So I think this is the main takeaway from this presentation, that TANF child-only cases are not one thing. They are many things, and we focused on three of the largest types. The first is what we call non-parent caregiver, or NPC cases. That's children living in the home of relatives. A second is children of parents who receive SSI. We call those SSI cases. And then finally, a set of cases which involve U.S.-born children whose parents are ineligible because of immigration status, and we call those IIP cases. So as I go through the presentation, I'll refer to those three types. I don't expect you to take a good look at this. Again, it's available in the report, but it shows that there's great variation in the policies among the focal states, which makes them an interesting point of comparison. So if you look at assist child adult-only TANF cases to apply for SSI, you'll see that that was happening in New York, at least in New York City and in some districts. It was state policy in Illinois. It was not state policy in Florida. So we were looking at a variety of situations across the states. When we talk about TANF here, we're taking a very broad view of TANF. We're including the TANF federal grant, as well as state expenditures and the other cash assistance initiatives that are tied into TANF at the case, at the state level. This chart, again, is more of an overarching visual. I don't expect you to look particularly at those states, though you can in the full report. It's to show that in 2011, there was great variation. So if nationally, two out of five cases were child-only cases, you'll see that in Idaho, for example, child-only cases made up the vast majority, almost 90% of TANF cases, while in other states, such as Hawaii, they made up only 18% or so. So when we look state by state, we see great variation. We also see great variation in the types of categories among the four categories, adult-only, NPC child-only, SSI, and IIP. You can see in this cross-section of states that in some states, NCP cases, such as Maryland, are the vast majority of child-only cases. In other states, such as California, the immigrant cases are the majority. Finally, there's variation over time. So if we look at this chart in the middle, you can see some states, such as Oregon, where you see that though the child-only caseload stayed about the same between 2007 and 2010, that was because there was a decline in the number of NCP cases while a great increase in the immigrant cases. So when looking within a state, different types of cases drive caseload growth. I'm going to now go through the three sets of cases and our key findings and then suggest some take-home points for policy and practice. The key findings for the NCP cases are that they are the largest category of child-only case in more than half of the states. Interestingly, also, we found that only 42% of NPC child-only cases are enrolled in SNAP. So that's not clear why that is true. That comes from our own investigation of the administrative data. In some cases, it may be that they're not eligible or were not eligible at the time for SNAP. It also may mean that they're not being brought to SNAP for applications when they might be eligible. So NPC arrangements are also diverse in origin. Some cases might be initiated by kin. Others may be driven by involvement in the child welfare agency, and that's something we'll come back to again later, the need for TANF agencies and child welfare agencies to understand this phenomenon together. So while there was a drop in NPC cases, we don't know this for sure, but it may be that that was related to what was going on in the foster care system and increased exits by adoption to kin or guardianship. For the immigrant cases, we see that during the time period we looked, there was a great rise in the number of cases nationwide, but at the same time, there are many states with almost no IIP child-only cases. Interestingly as well, the number of IIP cases is only weakly correlated with the number of unauthorized immigrants in each state's labor force based on estimates of that. So it is not driven only by the number of unauthorized immigrants, but also by state policy and practice toward them. In California, households with IIP child-only aid are larger than other types of TANF-aided households, and they include, of course, more TANF-ineligible adults as well as children. The income per person is about one-third lower in IIP child-only than in adult-aided TANF families, so some great need within the immigrant cases. SSI cases then present us a different policy and practice challenge. SSI receiving parents are already suffering from poverty, work incapacity, and disability that makes them eligible for SSI. SSI provides a basic grant, and that is, of course, supplemented in some states. But especially when you look at TANF policy, these are not parents likely to be able to work their way off TANF, and we see that those cases remain on TANF longer than other cases. This chart shows the children in child-only cases stay on longer. This is a cohort where, if you look at the left, 100% are initially observed in October of 2005. And after 60 months in the orange bar, the adult-aided cases have dropped to just 20% of those originally on. So there's quite a lot of exit over 60 months from the adult-aided cases. The three types of child-only cases are slower to exit, and the light pink line, the SSI line, shows the slowest movement or the longest length of stay. Considerations for policy for NPC cases. TANF funds appear to be used in many states for what could arguably be called child welfare purposes. So again, the need to coordinate policies between those two systems. TANF grants are smaller than foster care payments generally, and they don't reflect the cost of actually caring for children. Kin caregivers with NPC child-only TANF grants receive little or no supervision and are less likely to be connected to services. That's something our other speakers will be talking about. And TANF funds spent on foster care, and that in quotes, this is not official foster care, but these are funds then drawn out of the TANF system and are not available to support the goals of family self-sufficiency. So we have conflicting terminology and, as I'll come back to, lack of data to really help us think through these challenges. With the immigrant cases, let me very briefly summarize some considerations for policy. These resemble TANF families who might be in adult-aided cases, but they are, of course, not eligible or are within the five-year bar on assistance. Citizen children of unauthorized immigrant parents may suffer broad and negative effects of poverty and, again, have multiple disadvantages when it comes to linguistic disadvantage in schools and social exclusion. TANF administrators, interestingly, reported very little knowledge of the needs of these families. Few services were provided, either through TANF maintenance of effort or state dollars. And IIP child-only TANF is an important, but it's only a partial safety net until we see a different approach to immigration and support for immigrants. In SSI, again, disabled parents suffer many challenges, including, in these cases, support for children. Many SSI receiving parents have not enrolled their children in TANF child only. The only 28% of the children of SSI receiving parents are estimated to be enrolled in TANF child only. So this is an important population, but it actually could be bigger, though there may be some reason that SSI families are not also finding their way to the TANF system. Key informants cited the many needs. They include a set of services, child care, housing assistance, mental health services, but these are difficult because TANF programs are not designed to provide this type of service for SSI receiving parents and their children. Overall, we see that it's useful to track and analyze child-only cases, not just as a type and in themselves, in and of themselves, but also by these three subtypes. And we believe that federal and state data systems should be updated to capture this information. So my following speakers will have more to say on this issue. This is a way to contact me. And again, if you're interested in more details, you can download this full report at this URL. Or if you can't write that down very quickly, you can search for Chapin Hall Child Only TANF and find a link to that. So thank you again for having me. I hope this provides an overview for some more in-depth discussion later in the webinar.
Thank you so much, Matt. And so as you can see, we have another polling question for you guys to respond to, which is, does your state or county offer relevant caregiver services in child-only cases beyond cash assistance? And we'll give you a few moments to respond. Thanks, everyone. So we will now hear from Juliana Hernandez.
Hello, everyone. This is Juliana Hernandez. I'm a child welfare program specialist from the Children's Bureau, and I look forward to talking to you about the Kids with Navigator and TANF Child Welfare Collaboration Grant. Kinship care is the full-time care, nurturing, and protection of children by relatives, members of tribes, godparents, step-parents, or another adult who has a kinship bond with a child. The Kinship Navigator program assists relative caregivers accessing government benefits, mental health and legal services for the caregiver and the children they are raising. In 2009, the Children's Bureau, as part of the Family Connection grant, awarded 6 Kinship Navigator grants. And in 2012, the Children's Bureau awarded 7 Kinship Navigator grants aimed to support child welfare and TANF collaboration to assist kinship children who might be at risk of entering the child welfare system. One of the main components of the project was that grantees were looking to increase awareness of the TANF child-only grants as one public benefit that is available to families. Kinship Navigators assisted kinship caregivers in applying for and receiving TANF. I've included here a list of the 2009 and the 2012 Kinship Navigator grants, and I'm going to provide us with a few highlights of some of the work that the 2012 TANF Child Welfare Collaboration Grant. Some examples of TANF collaboration from the 7 different projects. The Children's Home Inc. in Tampa, Florida, used a model of having peer-to-peer navigators who were trained by the TANF agencies on TANF eligibility rules and then conducted home visits to caregivers' homes using a laptop and assisting them in applying online for TANF grants. The grants also had an interdisciplinary team intervention that allowed families with complex needs be able to meet with a whole team of professionals in mental health, substance abuse treatment, and education. The Homes for Black Children grantee in Detroit, Michigan, has huge collaboration with tenant workers and with those kids at the public school. That was another way for them to gain referrals and to learn more about teaching families in their community and to encourage them to come to Homes for Black Children where they were to learn more about becoming a foster parent and also being helpful facilities for these families. The New York State Kinship Navigator Program served over 1,000 families and provided educational traction to them around TANF and other public health programs. TANF agencies were referring kinship families to the Navigator Program, who then followed up within 48 hours with these caregivers, explaining to them the host of services that are available to them. Grantee also had a huge component of training both child welfare workers and patients to better understand the needs and the services that are available at the county level for the child welfare and patients. One of the other grants was United Way of California, run by Foster Collaborative, an online resource portal to connect kinship families with community services, private business resources, and public benefits program. She also employed former foster youth at staff for community outreach to kinship caregivers. All of the 7 grants are required to have a local independent evaluator, and all of the projects use one assessment tool, which is the family needs scale, to be able to ask families self-report what are their grants. So I'm going to just show some highlights from the different grants about what caregivers reported. So in the New York State Kinship Navigator Program, 58% of the 303 families that were included. And the financial need was created also by teacher concerns and need for more social support. United Way of California 211 on foster grants reported at the 6 month level that 90% of the caregivers had a decrease in being able to receive assistance and so no longer needed help getting furniture or clothes, was being able to access legal assistance, being part of a caregiver, support, overseeing dental care for their family. There was also improvements to self-reported health and well-being that was much less than short for 12 months. There was 141. And the Community Coalition of South Los Angeles has parenting group has found that the caregivers in the group did receive report fewer overall needs in following areas of financial, food and shelter, educational, child care, and transportation. Caregivers also reported that the use of food group programs that their parental stress levels had decreased. I'm also highlighting here from the Children's Home Grant in Florida that at intake, when they asked caregivers about which caregivers were receiving a foster care payment, there was only less than 1% of the caregivers that were receiving a payment, and there was 21% of the caregivers that were receiving a child-only payment. And this is just to show you that the caregiver families were receiving very different types of public benefits and assistance, staff and weight and food and free and reduced lunch. I've included the website link that you will find in our PowerPoint presentation. There was around 40% of the caregivers that reported receiving free and reduced lunch for their physician they were caring for, and over 30-45% of the families were also receiving staff. 20-30% were receiving wage shelter. The Florida grantee also was able to show that TANF revoked had increased at the 1 year time frame. So they were looking at comparing usual child welfare services by the Florida shared with those intensive caregivers that were their patients. This project also used peer-to-peer navigators, and there were four different groups that they had. But the peer-to-peer navigators had the highest panic application rate, 75%, and were able to control 53% of the this was much higher compared to the usual air travel services, which had the lowest panic rate, 25% in enrollment rate. So all of the grant projects were tasked with, you know, conducting these focus groups, caregivers and asking them about how was their experience in terms of applying for panic or physical panic. So what we've done is decided to give you a highlight of some of the issues that caregivers raised and some of the best practices. The main issue that most caregivers experience is they do interact with eligibility requirements to their patients and understanding whether they would be eligible for panic. All of the Census Navigator grantees were tasked with working collaboration with their TANF agents to learn and understand the eligibility rules that their state provides reliable about TANF eligibility. As we mentioned in the Florida case, there was a lot of lack of secure access and difficulty applying online for many Census caregivers, and that's clearly why the Florida Children's Health Care grantees decided your Kinship Navigator approach really has the technology and resources to be able to the caregiver get fired. We found that the peer Kinship Navigators had more success in the project, especially because they were families who also had gone through the process, they could also apply it online. So they were able to work with the families to make sure that they had all the. And in California and Florida, caregivers had reported that some of them were not able to meet TANF eligibility because the caregivers were not in a particular relationship. This was a safe option. The Kinship Navigator grant in those areas are continuing to work and educate their state that that is a state option and it's not a federal requirement. So the Kinship Navigator grantees, for example, in the states of Vermont and Colorado have legislation in their state that says that family can be one or more and the children living with both a parent and a caregiver. So we've included a link to the Vermont about that. Another concern was around some caregivers did not want to provide the biological parent information for child support purposes. Going to have at the next slide talk a little bit more about the good cause exemption waiver. The TANF policy for 84-29-30 Act, the state has the option to find a good cause exemption if you're so capped that filed and applied in each state by the state agency program. So we've included the reference there. And for example, in New York State, the TANF agency provided an informational letter to all of their county health insurance districts explaining that non-parent caregivers have the right to be caused for failure to cooperate with health enforcement and to provide clarification on when special circumstances during related emotional harm to by a non-parent caregiver. It also emphasizes to districts that non-parent caregivers tend to give them a smile if complying with child support requirements would result in any type of harm for the child. So we've provided a link to the New York State informational letter and also the New York State section about that program. And then there's some general recommendations for parents how well for collaboration. All of the grantees use a single statewide helpline for potential caregivers to call and learn more about what resources are available in their state and to invest in training and guidance around what are the kind of eligibility requirements in your state and how to do best to outreach to informal caregivers that may not be tied to the child welfare agency. This will be benefits for the kind of health grants. And I'm going to leave you with just some references of a child welfare leave application that came out last year that references articles from all seven navigator grants and my contact information. And now you'll be hearing more directly from Julie Trennan, Dr. Parker, Arizona Association for the Welfare Program.
Julie, I believe you're on mute.
Thank you. We're working to improve the audio. Julie, at this time, can you go ahead and unmute your phone?
Sorry about that. I'm Julie Tryon. I'm the program director of the Kinship Support Services with Arizona Children's Association. We offer information and education to our caregivers. We also offer peer support, the navigators that actually help them find resources, and we have a Children of Incarcerated Parents program. The most utilized service that we provide is information, education, and referrals to resources. In a three-year period, we served 4,845 caregiving households that were caring for 8,280 children. That's huge. And most of those families were given information to connect them to resources. With some folks, we offer the kinship information session and the adoption and guardianship training. Both of those classes are geared towards former families in the care and custody. The child is in the care and custody of the state. Other services that we offered were open to both the formal and the informal caregivers. Of note, in Tucson, we would use the Gabriel Giffords Family Assistance Center, and in Phoenix, we would use the CAG Center. And those are financial assistance agencies that help people weed through the eligibility requirements for the TANF and other welfare support in Arizona. We also offer peer support groups. That's probably the second most vital service for our clients. The navigation support, we provided 11,211 services, most of those by phone, but 3,372 in person over 3 years, helping families figure out all the various systems that they're involved in, whether it's child welfare or the TANF agency, the court, licensing, etc. One of our exciting programs is the Children of Incarcerated Parents program. They give navigation just like every other family, but they also get help learning how to navigate the criminal justice system. And the research shows that kids that maintain contact with their parents who are incarcerated do better, as long as that visit is about the child. And so we do have a visitation program where we help educate the caregiver about how to focus those visits on the child. And then we provide van rides to the Perryville Prison. That's a women's prison, and the Lewis Prison, which is very in close proximity. For folks who are incarcerated in other prisons, we can give their family members a gas card as long as they prove that they're using it to visit with the child. We also for Programming for Adults from Zambia, and then post-release, we did some reunification services to help stabilize that transition time to prevent reincarceration and then instability with the children. As part of our project, we took our clients that were in our database, the nearly 5,000, and did a check on the children with the FAA TANF system to find out how many of them were indeed receiving benefits. And we found only 13% of the caregivers could get matched, or the children could get matched. That's 13% are receiving the TANF child-only benefit. 3% are benefit cap. Benefit cap is a the state policy that is aimed at preventing folks who are receiving TANF from increasing the amount of their TANF received by having more children. 84% of the clients that were served by us were not receiving TANF, and many of those, the reason is simply because they never applied. This is the information on the TANF back benefit cap, and there's a link included that will help you research the law. We found that only a small percent, 3%, were not receiving benefits due to Arizona's benefit cap. When we looked at the four counties where our navigators were located, we found that these are the kinship placements that were receiving TANF benefits by county. We saw a great big difference, co-chiefs of Pima County. And when we did a all 15 county check, we found that co-chiefs of Pima County did stand out for the large number of kinship families that are receiving TANF, and that the rest of the counties fell along the lines of Pinal and Maricopa County. We were hoping that it was our navigator that made the difference, but as we looked at it, there were some processes put in place by the Department of Child Safety in Pima and Cochise County that added to that. In Cochise County, at the level of CAFE, there's a kinship liaison in every Department of Child Safety office. And in Pima County, which is a larger county that serves the Tucson metro area, they had a kinship liaison, a kinship support unit where liaisons assisted in that benefit, helping them apply for the benefit. When we look at the reasons why these kids were in kinship care, we asked everyone, child in your care, not with the parents. 65% come into this category one, substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health issues, abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Those would be issues that we're pretty sure the child welfare agency would be involved in if the kin caregiver had not stepped in. The category two also includes parental incarceration and death. And so if you take the category, all of the Category 1, add the few from the Category 2, the extra 10%, you'll come out to the 75%. And then the others were just financial reasons for immigration. And then we look at those that were informal to start. These are kids that never penetrated the child welfare system because they were in kin households, being supported, and we did work with those and caregivers to support the kids. That's a pretty large number, and actually the cost savings for the state are pretty high. Some of the lessons we learned on this project working with TANF is having a high-level participant from TANF really facilitated problem resolution. The FAA gave the contact information of somebody at the program manager level, which is actually a pretty high level, that the navigators could contact to resolve any eligibility information. Oftentimes, they can be turned down because an incorrect box was selected, and so the information is not accurate. As that criteria is complicated, we worked with TANF, and they suggested to leave the eligibility determination to them. It's best to have all the kinship caregivers apply and then let them sort out the eligibility. The other thing that we learned is that all the information needed to apply for financial assistance is available to the child welfare in their computer data set. And so right now, the state is examining the possibility of when children are in the custody of DCS and are placed with kin, that application would be automatic. And they have to find out if that's a policy issue that they need to change. There are many individuals who believe legislation needs to change. In Arizona, the family must positively apply in order to get benefits. Arizona Kinship Support Services, that's our address of our main facility, and my contact information. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. And very shortly, you'll see our next and final polling question up here before you, which reads, does your TANF program collaborate with your child welfare program by coordinating services or sharing data? I'll give you a few moments to respond. Okay, next now we will hear from Natalie Williams. Natalie, you have the floor.
Good afternoon. I'm Natalie Williams, and I am presenting this morning, or this afternoon, on a TANF Child Welfare Grant that we had a demonstration grant in 2005 for 5 years. And I think I need some help advancing my screens because I've lost my advanced capability. Our grant was called Jefferson County Community Connections, and again, like I stated, it's a TANF Child Welfare Grant. In our agency, we have 7 divisions, which include TANF Child Welfare. We have our cash assistance or food assistance programs. We have a justice services component. We have a Head Start and a workforce. And so we use a lot of our demonstration grants as models to show us how to enhance practice across all systems. Our program model for this grant included the practice of family group conferencing. We added a comprehensive family assessment for all of our participants that were in our grant program. We had a parent partner component, which is a mentor and advocate for the families going through the system. These are parents or people that have gone through the systems themselves. And we added this year, or that year, a community collaborative component. So we made it a part of the community as well. Our evaluation model was randomized study, placing families in 1 of 3 interventions. And those conditions were based on the randomization of them. And we used quantitative and qualitative data. Our group interventions were the certified family assessment. That was group 1 only. And then we added in if they randomly got into group 2, they had a family group conference and a certified family assessment. And the third group was adding a parent partner mentor to the family group conference and the certified family assessment. Really, the focus of our grant was we wanted to help the families that were in TANF, not go into the child welfare system or use the TANF system to help strengthen the families in the child welfare system to exit them out of the system itself. But overall, we were looking for system change. How could we do this? How could we change our practice? How could we increase our communication amongst individuals or individual workers in the seat? And so we were looking for department culture change. We monitored our culture as families came in. We wanted to understand what were our families facing as they entered these two systems. We looked intently at what did staff development need to look like to improve service delivery between these two systems? What did leadership need to look like for staff at a managerial, a supervisor, and a director level? What were our customer-driven practices? What did they want? What was their critical to quality for services? And how could we help them be empowered through this process and drive this process? And we found a lot of that happening in the family group conferencing piece, where the families were able to state without professionals in the room what they needed and to develop a plan for themselves and then present it to the professionals as a way of saying, help us in this way. This is what empowerment looks like to us. We increased the idea of inclusion and support systems. So including people's natural support systems that they identified, and if they didn't identify, encouraging them to find and identify some support systems outside of our human services department. And we increased community awareness. When we pulled the data for the articulation area for these families, we realized that a large percentage of our families in our child welfare system and in our welfare systems were coming out of a certain area. And so we took that data to that area, and we set up a community collaborative, and we said, this is your data. What do you want to do with it? How can we work together collectively to get to the root cause of a lot of the issues of why people are not being successful and they're having to enter these systems? And we found that to be really rewarding and really successful in our sustainability plan. Our systemic and our community partnership outcomes was to include increased and improved sharing data mechanisms. We reported successes in the collaboration. The collaboration still to this day, 6 years later, is still going on. We decreased duplication of services, so it helped us be more efficient and effective with our service delivery. We increased accessibility to services. We adopted a model to say, whatever we need to do, let's do it. If we don't have the resources, maybe our community does have the resources. We increased the number of families involved in the development of their own services plan. So instead of us telling them, they really guided the process and we added the support. We increased the number of families having access to and supportive services network. That was long-term sustainability for the families, which is once we pulled out, we wanted them to still have access to services and the ability to move forward in their progress. And then the progress of the JCC Steering Committee, as I said, that committee has morphed into its own nonprofit now and is really looking at how they can heal some of the social issues within their own community. Our family permanency outcomes, we decreased the number of children in out-of-home placement. We decreased the length of stay for children in out-of-home placement, and we decreased the number of children re-entering out-of-home placement. The family safety outcomes was a decrease in the number of children who were substantiated for child abuse and neglect, and the reduction in overall subsequent reports of neglect. The family well-being outcomes was to increase self-sufficiency, and that was started from the beginning. As we monitored the grant progress through the data, we had to make some adjustments throughout. We didn't just let the process ride out completely. We would adjust and verify what we needed in order to help the grant be as successful as possible for the people that it was serving. And we improved the family functionality in the areas of social support, family resources, reduced stress, parenting, and substance abuse. That we monitored on the family assessment. We did have a lot of challenges, and the challenges came because we were trying to shift culture and how business was done, and that was throughout our whole agency, but we used this as a tool to really dig in because we felt like this was serving the most vulnerable people that were coming through our doors. And a lot of that was, how do we make sure that these processes are sustainable and that they're worth the 5 years, the money and the time and the staff development we're putting into it? we had a hard time in our grant with the recruitment and retention of families because they're so mobile. I spoke to the culture change, and really from the beginning, the problem was how do we grow this program within current budget? And so what we found is we elevated this program halfway through it to report to the executive level. And so it decreased the number of barriers that individuals or line staff could put up in order for the program not to be successful because it did look like practice shifting. Overall, I love this quote because this is something that we looked at throughout the whole process, which was we needed to maintain a clear understanding of how the program fits into the whole picture of systemic change, because that's what we were doing. We weren't just saying TANF child welfare, this is all we're looking at. It was TANF child welfare with somebody who it was incarcerated within that family or somebody that needed early childhood education in that family. And so we used this as a way of dealing with root cause issues, but keeping in mind that we were up to really systemic change. The importance of staff, this has proved to be our next level of development in our agency, really spurred out of our systems of care grant and out of our TANF child welfare grant. We had 10 years of those grantee projects going on. We really brought it down to the staff is the most important key in making these changes. And so giving the staff the tools that they need, the time that they need, and the support that they need to get that done. On a very specific level, we looked at span of control. So how many staff do supervisors report, and was that an appropriate balance? What was our resource engine? What did our pay and benefits look like? Monitoring our turnover, and then really emphasizing coaching and development and leadership. Today, we still sustain these thoughts, and we're moving forward and saying not only TANF child welfare, but child welfare, but through our agency, how do we become an empowerment model for all the people that enter our doors, including our staff? The emphasis on, yes, we can do it. We may not always have the answer right away, but we've developed partnerships and relationships in order to say we will try anything to get people what they need so that they can move out of our systems. The goals are for everybody. We invite community partners to be a part of everything that we do. We let our staff know our jobs do make a difference, not just in our community, but in the world. We employ the best and well-trained workforce, and we set our sights on becoming an employer of choice. And that is it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie. And so we'd like to use our last few moments to for the listeners to ask any questions that they have for our presenters. And as a reminder, you may ask any questions by submitting a question by using the chat box feature. If you have a question for a specific presenter, please be sure to state that in your submission. While we're waiting for questions to pop in, I'm going to start out by asking a question for each of the speakers to respond to. What advice do each of you have for TANF programs interested in better serving relative caregivers and children in child-only cases? Any one of you can jump in on that.
Hi, this is Matt. I will start by saying, which I think came through in the other presentations, that a key piece of this seems to be collaboration, that not allowing families to fall into an individual program and service field without a broad look at their needs and how other agencies might fit into serving those needs seems to be a starting point that I would recommend.
This is Natalie Williams. I would agree. I think the process needs to be empowering for the families and for them to drive it. I think we need to listen and help them put together a plan, but really hear them and their dreams and their goals and their hopes and figure out how to create a vision, help them create a vision beyond their current situation.
This is Julie Trina. And I agree with those two statements, and I would just add one more thing. A lot of the TANF
that the A type of agencies are going to an online application only. And we still have a large segment of our population, especially when you're talking about grandparents raising grandchildren, that do not have it even the comfort with online. So we need to offer some old school ways of applying as well.
Hi, this is Liliana. I would also just add that TANF programs have flexibility in terms of providing short-term benefits available to kin, in addition to the TANF child-only grant. If the TANF and the child welfare agencies jointly conduct outreach to kinship caregiver families, ensuring that there is clear understanding of what the eligibility rules are for the TANF child-only, that would go a long way.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to throw out one more question for all of our presenters. What services may be most beneficial for adolescents in child-only cases? And are you aware of any TANF programs that are providing services to older youth?
I am not the person to speak to the latter part of that, but I think that it is important that in TANF child-only cases, we take the same perspective we're beginning to take with youth aging out of foster care, some of whom might be in relative placements that seem very similar to TANF child-only cases. And they're really thinking about the fact that the youth will be aging out of the system, however we think of the system, and what services are needed for that preparation for adulthood seems important. So there may be lessons from the CHAFE program or other efforts in child welfare to apply to youth in TANF agencies as well.
Hi, and this is Liliana. I would add to that that most of the grantees did have support groups for the caregivers, and so it is also important to have training or programs available to caregivers and adolescents, especially since many of the caregivers might not be familiar with social media or technology that the that adolescents are using. So it's important for us to look at training and activities that are using positive youth development approaches. And as Natalie was saying, if it is possible for those cases where there is child welfare involvement, to make sure that adolescents are being included in any type of family team meeting and that they are being able to say what are the services that they need assistance with. Grantees also found that many caregivers needed assistance around educational support services for the children that they are raising. Some of these children or adolescents may have special education needs in school and need to make sure that they are fully aware of the services that are available to them.
Hi, this is Natalie. I would add to that not to operate services or the need for services in a silo, to look at our nonprofit partners, our faith-based groups, our school partnerships, what else is being offered to other kids that are not in our system, and how do we access those? If there's a financial component to it, then we work through our system to look at what our financial resources could be used for those financial component needs, or if there's scholarships available.
Okay, I don't see any questions coming in, so that tells me that our presenters did a fantastic job in their presentation. So what I'd like to do now is just thank everyone who participated in today's webinar, and a very special thanks to Matt, Liliana, Julie, and Natalie for sharing with us today. Please remember to provide your feedback on this webinar using the survey that will appear in the seven pop-up window when the webinar ends.
Mr. Butler?
Yes.
I had posted a question, but apparently it wasn't seen in the box. But I just did want to share a couple of resources. This is Anna Beltran with Generations United. And we've done some work in this area, including some work that Liliana cited. And there are two publications available on www.grandfamilies.org. So right there on the homepage, you will see two publications about specifically about improving TANF access for relative caregivers. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I did want to share that, and it didn't appear to be visible. Thank you.
No problem at all. Thank you very much. Lisa, are there any other questions on your end?
Yes, I see a number of questions. Lisa, would you be able to read the questions? Unfortunately, we're not able to see them.
Yes, I can. So I'm giving 1 second. I go down to the next question. Okay. To what degree does the size of the TANF block grant present a limitation? And I think this is to everybody. Or if nobody wants to take it.
Well, yes, as I noted in my presentation, the notion of the block grant and its fixed nature means that it's very difficult for resources to expand to meet needs as they change over time. And I think if you look at the subgroups of child-only cases, that becomes especially apparent that it would make sense that over many years or decades, there will be changes in the needs of a population. So, again, thinking about the TANF system itself, one would hope that those resources are most directed toward achieving the specific aims of the TANF population and that other service systems coalesce around it to serve families that better fit those needs.
This is Julie from Arizona, and I know that with the population that I serve, they're very grateful for the amount of money that they're getting. They find life impossible without it, but they don't report that it's a large help towards all of the bills raised as a child.
Okay, I think that's really helpful. I have another question specifically for Natalie. What family assessment do you use when determining an overall family service plan?
The family, I'm not sure currently what they're using since we've been out of this grant. If you could take a name and number, I can get back to them with that. I know the family assessment that we did use, they're not currently, they've changed that and updated it. We do some assessments with another project we're working on, really looking at poverty and where the family is with their mental health and their poverty. But as far as the child welfare system, if you take a number, I'll have the TANF manager get back to that person on it.
Okay. I will note that. And then I have a question. Were Arizona ICTC kinship families included? Are they eligible for TANF in Arizona?
So the answer is ICTC families we do accept for service. Any kin raising their relative's child is eligible to receive our service. As I didn't work for the TANF agency, so I don't know if they would be eligible for the benefit. I do know that if the parents are licensed foster care that are coming for the ICTC and they're receiving a benefit through the child welfare system to be foster care, they're not eligible for the family owner, for the child owner.
Okay, great. And I actually have a comment in the chat box. So it looks like somebody in Arizona. It says, in Arizona, TANF benefits in child welfare and child-only cases are only available to children under state custody. But then there's some questions for all of you. From the grantees you presented, do your states include children who are under tribal custody?
This is Natalie. I believe Colorado does recognize and include children that are under tribal custody.
Does anyone else want to answer that, or? And then there's a general question. This might be Matt. This might be for you. Are the ages and percentages of child-only TANF cases higher in states where TANF payments are higher?
That is an excellent question. And I do not know the answer to that. I would have to look at whether that was actually something covered in the report. I'm afraid I just don't know, but I will actually look in the report and see if I can come up with an answer to that.
And I believe, James, that is all. I think that is all the questions I have right now, except for that the slides will be available. Be made available to everyone within a week or two.
Okay. Thank you, Louisa. And again, thanking everyone who participated in today's call, particularly our speakers. And again, please remember to provide your feedback on the webinar using the survey that will pop up as you exit the webinar. Also, to let you know, a transcript and audio recording of today's webinar will be available in the coming week on our PRTA Network website. That should pop up on your screen. If not, it is prta.acf.hhs.gov. We'd also like to hear from you about future webinar topics, so please send us your ideas by email to prta@icfi.com. That's PERTASICFI.com. You can also help us expand our network and reach a greater number of people by directing interested colleagues from your local and state networks and agencies to our website. We look forward to your participation in future webinars, and we thank you very much for participating today. Everyone have a pleasant day.